Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Dave Robinson, a real raconteur legend in the music business. He's done a million things, and I guess he's mostly known for being one of the founders of Stiff Records, certainly a huge link in the chain of the history of the music business and rock and roll. Changed the way things are done that I think we're still feeling now. So, interesting guy, interesting talk. This was a two-hour chat that we had. I've cut it down to about 90 minutes, which is still quite a bit longer than we usually get on this program. So, bear with it. I think you'll find it very interesting. Super interesting guy. He's working on a new project, a band called Hardwick Circus, and their new record comes out soon, so keep your ears peeled for that. Email me, michael@wfmu.org, and that's all you need to know. It's me and the great Dave Robinson. Good morning, Dave Robinson. Were you born in Dublin, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Born in Dublin in the 40s, and like everybody else, I, you know, at some point one has to get to England. That's the history of Irish people who plan to try and do something.
Was your folks musical? Were folks into music in your house when you were a little kid?
They were, remarkably, they were the United Kingdom amateur ballroom dancing champions. The music was a strict tempo kind of dance band. There's a gentleman in England who was very famous in the 30s, a guy called Victor Sylvester. And my father swore around his tempo. When I used to play Chuck Berry, he didn't like it at all.
So if you're born in the 1940s, do you remember the absolute first moment that you heard some kind of music that wasn't that? It wasn't dance music? Was it skiffle? Was it some Elvis or Bill Haley? What was it?
I had a friend, and he had a record player. My father didn't. So the music I heard at the beginning was, I think it was kind of Ricky Nelson, it might have been. But my cousin had what is known in Ireland as a carnival, same word in America, but traveling fair with dodgem cars and rides, you know. And it went around Ireland on a regular basis, and I loved going to it, and I was usually given the music to oversee on my stays there. And because they were playing 78s, you had to change them every three and a half minutes. And so Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Elvis, Presley, obviously, and several others of that ilk at that period.
Perfect. So I read something in your notes that you were involved in starting a beat club in Ireland called Sound City. So how old were you when this happened? What exactly is a beat club? And what was live music like before beat clubs?
Well, in Ireland, you know, the Catholic Church had a lot to do with everything. And Irish men and women were never encouraged. There always seemed to be some kind of problem in men and women feeling free enough to converse on many subjects. I noticed this particularly because the beat club I opened was when I was about 20. And the reason it's called a beat club was the Irish had very big ballrooms in the country. They had very big sheds they used to go to in the rural part of Ireland. And bands were called show bands. And they were about seven or eight pieces. And every major town, every medium town had their own show band. And each show band specialized perhaps in interesting music. For example, a group from Newry in Northern Ireland, they loved the Beach Boys. And they sang Beach Boy harmonies very well as well. So they did a lot of Beach Boy songs in their set. But they would also do the chart, the covers of the charts. They would do some country and western, because Ireland is very keen on that kind of music. And nothing original. That was always something I felt people should do. And, of course, when the Beatles came in, they tried. But every weekend, these huge sheds and ballrooms around Ireland would have men and women, men on one side and women on the other side of these very large halls. And the bands had set up a system, the show bands had a system, so the men and women didn't have to talk to one another. They would play a set of three songs, Foxtrot, three songs that were a waltz, or three songs that were a quick step. And they played, everybody ballroom danced. It was a culture in Ireland. Everybody could do some version of ballroom dancing. So the band would say, okay, we'll now have a set of slow foxtrots, which meant the men and women get very close. And the three songs would happen without the public talking to one another. And at the end of the third song, the show band would say, that's all for now, which meant that you would part, still not wishing. You might say thank you, but not wishing to have a conversation. But once an hour or so, or once an hour and a half, they would do a lady's choice. And that would mean that the gentleman would find out whether they were getting close to something. The parish priest regularly would attend and irritate everybody by watching what everybody was doing. The church had a very big grip on the Irish, and particularly the rural Irish. So a beat club, everybody in the cities got together in tennis clubs, not because they played tennis, but because the tennis club was a small version of the very big ballrooms. And the four-piece or five-piece small band would play very similar, maybe not so much country and western, but it was very similar material. And a remarkable phenomena, I always tell people, and they are amused by the fact that the show band would play for 4 hours right through. And halfway through, four of them would leave the stage to have their dinner in the back room. And the other people would play, would swap instruments and play, and then they would reverse courses. So a beat club was what I'd seen in England. You know, the Two Eyes, the kind of stuff that was a bit hipper, seemed a bit hipper, and it seemed to have some original material. And people were playing stuff from America, Louisiana, New Orleans. Little Richard was popular, Chuck Berry, and all those things I played in the carnival were played by four-piece bands mainly. So that's how it worked, and that's how the music for me started.
Is there still, if you go to Ireland now, is there some link to that ballroom dancing, or is that lost?
I believe there's a little link, but not a lot. People went through the jiving, the rock and roll kind of dancing. That became popular. So instead of a quick step ballroom dancing, people had watched Rock Around the Clock and The Girl Can't Help It. And so they had come on a bit with their dancing techniques. But that's not happening now. When we opened the club, we then quickly were cloned by about 20 people. So 20 clubs opened, and you know, we had a great initial period, but then it declined into, and now we're in digital music. Although Ireland still has a great affection for traditional Irish music and acoustic music, music played by people as against computers or machines. So there's still a very musical people singing a very big part of country and city life.
At some point, you fell into photography. You're still a teenager, I believe, and you're taking photographs of people in clubs and you'd sell them copies, or people on vacations. Somehow, you ended up photographing the Beatles. Now, I've read this in different ways about you a million times, but I need this broken down in much more detail. Was this an organized session? Was it some live photos? What happened to the photos? Where did they appear? Can we see them? Do you still have the negatives?
It was a magazine. There was two magazines I worked for. One I can remember very well called Rave Magazine, and the other I think was called Pop. So there were two magazines in the early 60s, and I worked for both of them. So the Beatles came about because I was sent to Liverpool. Liverpool was was starting to be noticed musically before the Beatles came to bring an incredible focus on Liverpool. So I was sent to Liverpool to do about 9 bands, and the Beatles were one of the 8 or 9 bands that I photographed, that I had a list from the magazine. And I went to the Cavern at lunchtime, and it was, you know, there was quite a few people. It wasn't by any means completely packed. And the Beatles were one of the bands that I did. I can't say that I've particularly noticed the music being any different to some of the other bands at the time. I was busy looking through the viewfinder and getting on to the next gig, so to speak. 3 or 4 of the bands, I mean, looking back, were doing the same material. I think Long Tall Sally was a song, but 4 or 5 bands did several songs that other bands did. There was a kind of rock and roll, Southern American kind of flavor to it all. All guitars, there weren't any saxes or anything. So the Beatles, you know, passed me by. I remember Paul McCartney because he was very friendly and very keen to get the photograph of his band. So he was a little organizing. I don't remember John at all. I saw him, took a picture of him, but I wasn't aware of him. He didn't speak to me. So the bands was a band live and then a photograph of them together in the dressing room, and they were the pictures. I didn't do anything with the negatives. The job entailed me writing down the left to right position. That was a very important thing. Getting the correct names of each band in my photograph left to right. And I sent the reels of film. I handed them into the office in London when I got back, and they used them as they wish. I did several of these kind of jobs. I also did, I went to Newcastle to do a similar outing. And to my mind now, remarkably, there were several of the same songs being played by what they called beat groups at that time.
So are these pictures of the Beatles included in books that we find now? Do you see them around?
I haven't really looked for them, but I haven't seen any live. There's very few, I have not seen a lot of live pictures from the Cavern. I do occasionally look for that one. Mm. Eventually, I managed bands that went and played in the Cavern in the later years. But the funny thing about shots of the Beatles around that time is I often look at them and think, did I take that?
Yeah.
But yeah, and a lot of other bands that I took in the same way, because they're kind of a blur. The 60s got to be very exciting. It was a bit of a blur. Yeah, it was great. And I have a brief relationship with Paul McCartney since, and we talked about that. You know, I mean, we didn't really remember each other, but he didn't remember me so much. But I've had a few things to do with him. Lovely guy. And a genuine person. And I've been in touch with him 4 or 5 times in my career where he was helpful.
Hmm. So at what point, what is the thing that happens where you think to yourself, well, maybe I can, you know, make a living? Because for the rest of your career, you're road managing and managing and running labels and everything to do with music. What is the thing that got you started down that road?
Well, taking pictures of the show bands, which became a lot of my business, the magazine called Spotlight in Ireland photographed the show bands, and I became their man of photography. And the bands always wanted promotional pictures, so they would then employ me to do a session, so to speak. I would then be paid a fee. And they would then want a lot of prints of various pictures. For a while, the show bands didn't really know about reproduction. So they actually wanted a glossy print, or they wanted thousands of glossy prints or hundreds. And I had 2 young girls working heating machine to turn out lots and lots of prints. As a result, I was making quite a living. And from there, I went to work for a magazine company that had 40 magazines. And so I could be doing some fashion shots in the morning, but they also had bike mags and various other mags. One was a veterinary Mag. So I could, in the afternoon, I could be working with taking pictures of a vet whose arm might be up the back of a cow, for example. and so it was a very good experience. And then I had all the bands. So I was actually making a very good living, and it was cash. The other interesting thing about show bands is that at the end of the evening, I noticed that the head of the show band, at 12 o'clock, would sit down with the promoter of the large ballroom, and they would put down a figure that they would both agree to, which was a lot less than the actual numbers of the people who had come to the dance. That was for the tax, the Irish tax system, and they would both be able to say the same number on any given night. So 3,000 people will be there, and they'd have 350, for example, that kind of thing.
So at a certain point, you roomed with Van Morrison and briefly managed him. I consider him super talented and also a super handful, to be polite. Was he always a super handful?
Yes, he was. In Ireland, as you know, the different religious situations of Protestant and Catholic have been there for 400, 500 years, and people have been arguing that. The north of Ireland was in a situation in 1918 or thereabouts. A treaty was arranged where the north of Ireland would stay with the UK, and the rest of Ireland would then gradually become a republic over a period of years. So it's a very interesting thing. Van Morrison was very Northern Irish. Northern Irish people have a kind of a rather gruff, kind of different manner to the Republic people. The Republic people seem to drink a lot, and they're very friendly as a result. And they're very chummy. People will talk to each other in a bar, and they will get into life stories quite quickly. Northern Irish was a bit more suspicious, and Van was one of those. I met Van through a band that I managed around that period. A group from Northern Ireland who had worked in England wanted to come to Dublin, and one of them came over and approached me with a view to gaining a manager. And I wasn't really into it. I didn't know the idea of management. I obviously, as a club proprietor and negotiator with the groups, I was obviously, some of them had managers and some of them just didn't. But I found it easier to deal with the ones who didn't have managers. So a group called The People came over from, they were working around Blackpool in England, and came to Dublin and came to the club and wanted to play. And that was fine. I heard them in rehearsal and thought this was very good. And they were based around Van Morrison and knew him. And one interesting day, I was up with them in Belfast, and they took me around to Van's house, which is a small row of terraced houses, one-story kind of terraced houses. He didn't talk a lot. He didn't seem to have any interest in talking to me particularly, but he had a great record collection that I had never seen before. There was a lot of material that I had not seen, and I thought I knew a bit about music at the time. I also photographed him for Rave magazine. Them were a very interesting band because they were getting £30 a week. Now, that was untold a luxury. Most bands struggled to have enough to eat. As long as they had enough petrol to get their van to the next gig, that's all anybody seemed to care about. But them were notorious for the fact that they actually, their manager gave them an amount every week. So they were seen as very, very wealthy. Van, it seems, discovered, this is what he told me, he discovered that under the agreement that they have, all these bands had two-page agreements. They were all a standard form, and it gave the rights of the manager to collect all the money on their behalf. What he did with it, it didn't specify, but he could collect it. So their manager had been picking up, publishing and any other amount of money. And he had been using that to pay the band £30. And Van discovered that essentially, as he was the only writer in the group, he essentially took the attitude that it was his money that was paying the rest of the band and himself, but he didn't count that. So when he heard that, he immediately decided to leave his management and leave his band and go home to Belfast. And he didn't enjoy Belfast going home to, because it's a funny town, like a lot of towns. You go home and you have been famous, and now you're not famous because the band have broken up. And, you know, the Belfast people thought that was kind of humorous. Their idea of humor did not appeal to Van. So he came to Dublin because he heard this club was going in Dublin. And he arrived just with his harmonica and a small weekend bag case, and turned up and said, you know, he found me there. So we actually knew each other from the couple of photographic sessions we had performed in. And he said, you know, I'm looking for a manager. I'm looking for a new band. I'm looking. And so I said, well, you know, I'm not into management. I don't know how that works. But if you're stuck for a place to stay, you could share my flat. I had a couple of bedrooms in the flat. So he came to stay with me as a result. But he was a terrible flatmate. he got rid of pretty much. I mean, I think he's a genius as well. I'm a huge fan. But he got rid of all the girlfriends and social life around me gradually. He had some very bad habits, but no small talk. He didn't like people talking about anything except maybe music or musical instruments or something to do with music. And so Bert Burns at that time was ringing him, and he gave me the phone on a couple of occasions. I didn't know Bert, but I was aware that he was he'd written, I think, Here Come the Night and Baby Please Don't Go. One of those two were two songs I really liked from them. So Van was giving me the phone. He didn't want to talk to him particularly. And I said, you know, why? You know, I've got nothing to do with this. Van would get up with bands in the club now and then to kind of pay me back a bit, seemingly. Of course, when Van played with them on harmonica, the bands would be much better than they were. They would kind of zip up a gear or two. I noticed that, his ability to bring people along with him musically. So Bert had, you know, he's telling me he had an apartment for him to go to. He was going to give him advances. He was going to support him. And he was going to write material with him and for him. And, you know, I said to Van, look, there's nothing here in Dublin. You should go. Why not? Go and try that. And eventually he decided there was nothing much in Dublin anyway going on. And he decided to go. And he did, to give him his due, he asked me to go with him. But I knew by now that Van didn't take prisoners very, very well. He wasn't into passengers. And so I declined, and I didn't see him then for quite a number of years. But I, you know, I constantly read about him and looked at him as a fan. So that was an interesting bit, that the Van's period.
And I guess he went to New York and made Brown Eyed Girl, and then the rest is history. So
he did. Yeah, he did.
So just to stay with this topic for a second, so around that time, late 60s, early 70s, Irish Man Goes to London, is there any prejudice that comes with that, or was that all cool?
Well, no, it was a very difficult thing. The early 60s, much to my amazement, because it never occurred to me and nobody had prepared me for it, if you were wanting to get a room, which was what people did, they would go to news agents, and the news agent would have a list, would have cards in the window, the room to let for, you know, a professional gentleman. But it would say no Irish, no blacks, or no dogs. And it amazed me. I had not been prepared. Nobody had mentioned this before. And I could easily assume an English accent, you know. But obviously, if I was black or a dog, I was stuck, you know. So,
how late did this continue? How long did things like that go on?
I was renting accommodation in London till 66, 67. To my knowledge, it was like that up to, say, definitely 1965, 66.
Yeah.
And I didn't always, they were not always the terms, but no blacks, no Irish was a regular one. The dogs every now and then was added. I don't know why. But lots of Irish people talk about that and talk about that period and talk about how they wanted to try and get their foot into the London or English situation. And that was there. That was in the shop window. But I would put on a posh English accent in every event to circumvent what was happening.
Interesting. You started road managing quite a bit. There's folks can... We can't cover every second of your career, and I wish we could, but you started road managing lots of bands we've heard of, including in the U.S., and it seems to me, just from talking to you, from reading about you, that you were a natural at understanding when a deal was going down, all sides of that deal, and I'm going to assume that was what made you a natural at doing that. So you worked with Jimi Hendrix. Was he easy to work with?
Yeah, he was very easy. I mean, the transition from being a photographer and club owner, because I had two partners in the club in Dublin, I decided to go back into photography because of, I was missing the large income that I had had from the photography. So I went back to London, got a job, and did very long overtime hours, which you could do at that time. And if you're Irish, you got your tax back. After 6 months, if you returned to Ireland, you could apply to the tax man in England, and he would give you your tax back. It was an arrangement between Ireland and England that, of course, a lot of Irish people took advantage of, because they would get they would write from home in Ireland, but really they'd be in England. So the money would arrive back, and they would actually be working at some different job. So it was very well, you know, orchestrated. Everybody did this. So one day, the people who I had left in Dublin, because I couldn't do any more with them, the Dublin ceiling to a musical career for a beat group, a four-piece band, was very low. And when you got to it, that was as far as you could really get. There was no record companies there. There was no anything. So you had to go to England. So this band, they were called The People. Interesting enough, Henry McCulloch was the guitar player. And Henry, you may know, was in the Grease band and also in Wings.
Right.
Eventually. So while he was in this Northern Irish band, they came and squatted in my flat. And I got evicted because, of course, musicians will never be quiet and will always be making noise in the middle of the night. So my landlady said, you know, it's in your terms of your thing that you can't have sublet or whatever. So I got thrown out. And for a brief period, had to live with the band in their van, which was very uncomfortable. So I got three shows for them. And one of the shows was, at that time, 1967, the kind of Haight-Ashbury kind of underground music, Grateful Dead, all that music from the West Coast was becoming quite the thing. And so a lot of people taking marijuana and going to clubs that with bubbles on the wall and light shows, et cetera, et cetera. So the show that I managed to get for the band, The People, was a show at one of these events. And Procol Harum were the headliner. And there was several other bands. It turned out that we weren't allowed to go on till 4 a.m, at which time the crowd was asleep. Well, the crowd had, you know, there was about not half, maybe a quarter of the original people in this club. So at 4 a.m, my band, I have to wake them up and get them in there and get them going. And they had a really good effect. Everyone was asleep, but the music, they're loud and they're, you know, very like them, very like a them band playing that kind of R&B stuff, rhythm and blues. And they had a very good effect. And when they finished, several of the crowd who seemed to have university gigs or things were offering me work at quite good rates. And I'm busy writing it all down. And this guy kept saying to me, you should talk to me first. You should talk to me first. And I said, yeah, I'll get to you. Just let me write, you know, and I'm writing away. The promoter at this point passed me by and he said, Dave, I should talk to this guy. That's Jimi Hendrix's manager. So, of course, I changed tack rather suddenly. And so we had a conversation. It turned out that he wasn't really interested in the talent of the band. He was interested that they could play. But his main wish was he owned three clubs in Mallorca off the coast of Spain, very popular at that time in the 60s. And the Spanish government and the British government had one of their never-ending arguments over Gibraltar. The Spanish wanted it back, and the English didn't want to part with it. So the Spanish had stopped all English work permits, so in order to negotiate. And this guy was upset. Mike Jeffries, his name. He was upset because he had three clubs and he'd been making a lot of money in the summer and he had no music to put it in because that was how the clubs worked. So he said, it is an Irish band, right? And I said, yeah, definitely. What I didn't tell him, of course, is that, you know, they had UK passports and were absolutely useless for what he had in mind. So I rushed to Southern Ireland where, as luck would, it takes about, the Irish are always a bit slow in the civil servant, particularly at that time. And it takes about, you know, 3 or 4 months to get it. Because first of all, I had to establish that they were Irish, even though Northern Irish, the Irish accepted that that was Irish. And so the band didn't want to get Irish passports, Republic Irish passports, because they said if anyone found out, they'd get killed. So I said, don't tell anybody. And meanwhile, I found a girlfriend who was working in the civil servant in the visa department, and she was able to help me. Luckily, we had parted on good terms, and so she got me passports for them. I had an Irish passport in a week or 9 or 10 days. So I could report back to Mr. Jeffries that I had the band and we were ready to leave. If he would part with some money, I'd get going. So off we went to Mallorca, and it was fantastic. We had a great time. The band played very well. You know, people talk about the Beatles in Hamburg and the difference between the Beatles prior to Hamburg and afterwards, because they were playing four or five sets a night with a lot of kind of amphetamines and things to get them through. But it really improved their music. And so the same situation. The people were playing in three clubs, six sets a night, and everything was great. It was a real holiday atmosphere. Mallorca was, all the European, young Europeans would go down there for a couple of weeks. So it was a very exciting time. So Chas Chandler turned up at this time. I was aware, I'd heard that Mike had a partner and that they'd signed this guy, Jimi Hendrix. So Chas turned up for a holiday in Mallorca, and, you know, he's the kind of guy who will always go to the music. And so he came to the club and he saw my band, the people playing, and he said to me, Dave, they're really good, you know. I really quite like this. You know, I might want to do something further. What do you think? And I said, oh, great, Chas, just marvelous. So Chas was the musical half of the partnership. Mike Jeffries was the money. So we got back from Mallorca, and I did spend 3 days in a Spanish jail, which is because I had obviously been getting, as the manager, I'd been scoring a few small bags of grass or something at the time. And the Guardia Civil, Franco was running Spain still at that time, and the Guardia Civil had been filming it. So they picked up everybody who had been going to this South African's house, and it was a very difficult time. Everybody was queer. There were 35 of us in a very small cell with a big hole in the floor as the latrine. Very unpleasant circumstances. And, you know, my turn to be questioned came on the third day because people would leave and they would not come back. So I thought, you know, what is happening? How can I get out of this? This is a difficult situation. Now, the Irish passport is half in Gaelic. So I decided, I had learned Gaelic at a very young age. Not that I was fluent in any way. I had forgotten most of it. But I decided I could only speak Gaelic. And so I frustrated the inquisitors by only being able to speak Gaelic. I mean, they didn't entirely believe me, but I had to really work hard at doing it. And then I was whisked out. Everybody was gone. There was only me and a Turkish guy who had been the bully on the beach. And I was whisked into a taxi. Nobody said anything. I'm smelling like a homeless person. I'm looking pretty bad. And I was taken to the airport and put on a plane to London. Nobody spoke to me at this time. Nobody sat near me either. I would stay on the plane. but I also was barefoot. Anyway, I ended up in London, and somebody picked me up from the airport, and it turned out to be one of Mike Jeffries. So the word was, Mike never explained it to me, but he supposedly had MI5 connections or had and was able to pull, or his money in Spain was his position. He was able to exercise and get me out. The band had already come to London, and suddenly we were in a situation to be managed by Chaz and Mike Jeffries. And I met Jimmy in a situation where I went for a meeting, a business meeting, to Chaz Chandler's apartment in the centre of London, and it had a glass door. So I'm ringing the bell, and it doesn't seem to be ringing. And this figure came and opened the door, and it was Jimi Hendrix, but I didn't know that. And he had his hair had about 100 curlers in it. You know, it's like a lady at the supermarket or something with curlers in her hair. And he was wearing a very, very short sarong-type outfit, which did not cover all his his parts, so to speak. So I was very frustrated. I was very flustered. I didn't know who he was. I thought I was in the wrong apartment. I didn't know what was happening. And I said, Chaz Chandler, and he just pointed. He didn't say anything. And I met Chaz. And Chaz said, oh, I see you've met Jimmy. So I just passed, you know, the great guitar biter, Hey Joe, who just surfaced on British television without knowing who he was, just thinking he was the nutter from next door. But we had a great meeting. Jimmy came in and looked great. He dressed thing. And the big game at that point was a game called Risk, which is a world domination kind of board game. So Jimmy and I were one team against Chaz and his new, very pretty Swedish wife. So that was my first connection. I'm with Jimi Hendrix. I'm on his team now, and we won. So the Robinson-Hendrix team, we got along very well. I liked it, you know. I mean, how could you not? He's already a famous person, very friendly, a bit shy, but very good at Risk, and he instructed me in all the subtleties. So there I was, my first meeting. I remember leaving and thinking, God, this is it. This could be it. This could be something. This is what I've heard about. So we did a few support bands for Jimmy in London, and then Chaz says about going to America, and it was like, you know, it was a talk about what you wish for. That was the big one. So we went and toured. Earlier than that, I did a big thing in England, were the big package tours, and Jimmy had a spot because of the Hey Joe bit. He was the headliner. The Pink Floyd were under him, and then there was the Move, the Nice, the People. Oh, we now had our name changed by Mike Jeffries and Chaz. We're now the Heir Apparent. So E-I-R-E, as in the Irish bit. So they weren't very happy. The band weren't happy with that. But we did want to appeal to the new management team. And so they accepted it. They just thought, well, I'll never go back to Belfast, was pretty much the attitude. Anyway, that aside, we started touring. And so, you know, I noticed all kinds of things. I was kind of interested in the whole procedure. That was my interest of how does this work? What happens? What will happen if the heir apparent now starts to get a bit of notoriety? What do I need to know? Who am I? What's it all about? And so it was fascinating. There was no criteria. It seems the Beatles, obviously, Herman's Hermits and the Animals were all the bands that had actually come from the UK to America at that time. So Jimmy and his two English partners, I got along very well with Noel Redding. And anyway, subsequently with Mitchell, I didn't. But Jimmy was fine. And here we are doing a very haphazard tour, which involved zigzagging all over the country and doing a lot of aeroplanes and various other things. And it was fascinating to me because it seemed to be very badly planned. And I thought, once you get to the big time, and this is the big time in America touring with a big star, that it would be very organized. It would be very organized, and it wasn't. It seemed to me. Then the tour manager got a gallbladder problem and had to go back to England, and so I became the tour manager. So I'd been the roadie. I'd been helping with the equipment as part of my job. So I hadn't really paid that much attention to him. I'd been interested in them, you know, catching up with how it worked. But being given that kind of responsibility was large at the time. And I was given a briefcase and a Beretta, much to my amazement, and a license to carry it concealed. Because the insurance in those days, it seemed you couldn't collect big sums of money, which you were expected to from a promoter, without a gun. So I never used it. I never looked at it. I put it in the bottom of the briefcase and forgot all about it. But it was, it was heavy. Touring America then was quite a difficult situation.
Let me remind folks that we're talking to Dave Robinson here. You managed Brinsley Schwartz, produced their early records. So in all the years of road managing, there must just, you know, getting from A to B, getting paid, as you said, sometimes a struggle. There must be a million crazy stories. What's, you know, one insane story that happened?
While I was the tour manager, the Vanilla Fudge, who had a track called You Keep Me Hanging On, where to join the tour. This is the Jimi Hendrix Heir Apparent Soft Machine tour. And they were to join the tour, and I got a notice of that. We were out, I think, Jackson, Mississippi or somewhere like, you know, the South, which is extra difficult, and negotiating through that. So the Vanilla Fudge were to join the tour, and I got the day and everything. But on that day, the gear didn't show up, and the band didn't show up. So, it wasn't important to me. I didn't even know the band. So I'm working on the stage before the doors are going to open, and I'm giving the word to the promoter to open the doors. And I'm just looking at a bit of equipment problem we're having when this slim gentleman in a mohair, you know, shiny suit comes up the hall with a very squat individual, very, very tough-looking individual with him. And he comes up to the stage and he says to me, I'm the manager of the Vanilla Fudge. Their gear hasn't turned up, so we'll have to use yours. And I said, fine, that's fine. I'll just have to check with the band. I mean, you know, it would have been normal, but I would check with the band. And the squat guy at this point had come up on the stage and he ripped my shirt off. The front of my shirt, he kind of ripped it off. He pulled it so hard and so quickly that this T-shirt thing I was wearing ripped, the whole of it ripped. And as I looked down at it and I looked up again, there was this very big gun in my mouth. I said, you can, you know, in a very mumble fashion, you can use anything you like. No problem, no problem, you know. Yes, you use the equipment. So it turned out that he was a member of a New Jersey kind of mafia family. And I stayed out of his way for the evening. The band turned up and used the equipment. I squared it all with Jimmy and the boys, etc., and got all the stuff that they wanted. And they performed. So the following morning at breakfast, I see the two of them approaching again. I think, oh, my God, what's going to happen now? But the guy, Philippe, his name was, he slipped an envelope under my plate and said, you know, I might have overreacted last night. Look, I'm sorry about that, whatever. If you would, I have to go back to New Jersey on business. If you'd look after the band for me, I'd appreciate it. And they left. And in the envelope, there was $3,000. Now, I was getting $150 a week. So this is fantastic. I hadn't realized my shirt was that valuable. But so that was one of the many. I mean, I had to pay off police in several places where they were blackmailing us at the point of young underage girls, maybe with band members and things. And you know, the jail is, you will be put inside for 20 years. It's the kind of attitude. So there were quite a few people with their hand out, and you had to skirt around this and take care. What was amazing for me was the fact that a lot of the promoters were very racist. I thought John F. Kennedy had sorted all this out, you know, from Ireland. I thought, well, the Kennedys have come and they're really getting all this sorted. That was not the case, and particularly the further south you went. But a lot of the promoters, you know, there were some great ones, etc., but a lot of them were very racist, and they would talk to you in a very way as if you... you know, familiar way. They would talk in a very nasty way about the clients and how they ran very clean shows and there'd be no XYZ allowed at them. They seemed to ignore the fact that Jimmy was black himself, was, you know, and that there was, I don't remember seeing half a dozen black people at any of the shows. They didn't come. He was very much a white item. And if he wasn't, the promoters were making sure that the audience were. I had to learn to keep my mouth shut. I'm a very talkative person, as you're probably finding. I can talk, and I also object to racism. Having come from a country where racism has been going on for 600 years, I resent all that kind of thing. But I had to. Mike Jeffries talked to me at one point and said, look, Dave, you look like as if you're going to talk on a few situations. You know, I would advise you to keep your mouth shut. You know, this is business and this is how it works in America. And you just need to go along with it. So, you know, if you feel saying something, you know, go outside and shout at the sky. But do not mention, you know, you will be serious. So it was a great experience and helped me greatly when it came to running a record company. I had this kind of quite broad, vast, varied experience, which all came in handy.
Yeah, let me ask you about pub rock. Do you think it's understood correctly in today's historical hindsight? Do people understand what it really was, and do they make too big a deal about it, or do they make not enough of a deal about it?
There was a period where the music was progressive bands playing 15 minutes in the key of E. You know what I mean? You had a lot of... Also, the major record companies loved the bands dressing up. You know, they loved it. They're not any different today. There's an analogy by Andrew Lou Goldham, who managed the Rolling Stones, where it's always pretty good. He said, if you have a can of beans, record executives would be interested in the can. You know, so I thought that was pretty much where it was at. These people were not really pushed about the music, and I became over the years interested in the artists. You know, not just showing off about that, but getting the group to their best showing, getting them on the stage, well rehearsed, everything happening well, very little. I hate pauses and people going 1-2 into microphones. I just resent it. I think all that has to be got together in a rehearsal room, and you know what you're doing, and you make it work. So the pub rock was, these are a lot of bands who don't have any record deals. And there was a lot of four-piece bands who sprang up in the early part of the 70s. Ace is a very good example, who happened to get one track away and make something of it, because they never found a second track.
Yeah.
But the other bands, in a reaction against this kind of crushed velvet, high heel boots, orange haircut, which the majors really liked, because they could think, oh, this is entertainment. This is, you know, they loved that kind of carry on. They thought it was quicker and easier for the public to relate to something that was, you know, some of it good music, but a lot of it very phony carry on. But they liked all that. And so the pub rock bands were bands that I because of handling Brinsley Schwartz, I wondered why we weren't playing more of London, for example, and why we wouldn't play. It's like the Beatles in Hamburg analogy and the people in Mallorca, is to have pubs where a band could do two or three sets, so they could play stuff they could write for it, but they could also play some covers that were interesting stuff, some blues, some early material. And a lot of that early material that they looked at were all short songs. So you're looking at no big guitar solos, short songs. There was a band called Eggs Over Easy who came from Marin County to make a record in London, and the money dried up. So they were stuck with no rent, no money. And they did what everyone in Marin County would do. They went to the nearest pub and asked for their worst night. And I turned up pretty much after they got the worst night, Eggs Over Easy. I heard this music coming from a pub that happened to be on my evening's movement. And I went in to see them, and I saw this band playing short 3-minute songs, really good, really excellent, very exciting, and as good as anything, as a small room and no people in it. And I started telling people about this band. And it didn't take more than a month, and I got a very good audience for this group and got some more gigs. And so the Brinsleys did a lot of these, and they were all in pubs, because pubs, I mean, what does a publican want? He wants people in front of his bar, so he will take whatever music will do that for him. Prior to that, a lot of the bands in England were kind of old, very old-fashioned jazzy bands, and they'd have an audience of 30 people. I put people in, and all these new bands that I was aware of because of the Brinsleys, because we saw these bands around all the time. They didn't have any money. They didn't have a van. They didn't have those kind of facilities. And I booked them into the pubs and gradually took on more and more and more pubs. All Irish landlords, so very keen. Yeah, if you're going to get people in, fine, we'll pay, blah, blah, blah. And so pub rock was a sneering aside from major company A&R men, so at that time. So they came, and because there was a movement, there was a feeling that these bands were happening, these pubs were full, people were talking about going to 3 or 4 gigs in a night to see 3 or 4 bands. And the majors, of course, sent their scouts out there who came away saying, oh, it's only pub rock. And it was a put down. Mm. Now, if you look at Stiff Records, it was made up of pub rock. And so a whole different idea of the music being important and a certain style of the music. And all those people that we look at, or them, or we admire, or Louisiana turning up great records. I mean, there was great music in America, and these bands used that to write off and also to cover. And so you could go out and have great music in a simple bar, drink a few pints, and this was what the major record companies wrote off. They just said, no, look at it. It's not, you know, the guy hasn't even got a good haircut, you know, whatever.
The transition from pub rock to punk rock, I find that super interesting time. Was it something, I mean, was it like you just said, you were, you know, Stiff Records had a lot of the same folks from the pub rock scene. Was the idea just to continue that scene, or did you feel a change in the air? Was there, you know, something political going on? Yeah.
No, very definitely. The one thing that was there was the circuit now. There was a pub rock circuit, and so anyone who had a band could get in on the worst night and build their following. It's all residency, so you get public who come on a Thursday, they'd come the following Thursday and the following Thursday. So each band could build up a bit of a following in London without running up any big bills. You know, you could take your drum kit in a taxi to the gig, you know, kind of thing. So punk filled the void as the pub rock bands moved on to Stiff, and big record companies then copied Stiff because they said, what's happening? Who are Stiff signing? Well, let's get some of those. It's like the Beatles. When the Beatles hit, everybody went up to Liverpool and signed a Liverpool band. Every Liverpool band got signed because the record company, they don't work it out. They've got a, you know, it's a very transparent kind of carry on. I mean, I'm very anti-major record company.
Yeah.
Punks obviously came in at that point. So we're looking at 76-ish. And the Roxy in London is full of people, a lot of people who can't play, but are very enthusiastic and are following certain New York trends that they kind of like that other people have not noticed or whatever. So you have a lot of things. Anyone can play. So it becomes a free-for-all. Anyone can play. Anyone can get an instrument. Anyone can look in the mirror and get themselves a bit of hair gel and look really interesting. And so we have all these bands. And then you have a guy called John Peel who came and had a, I don't know how he did it, but he got in the position of BBC Radio 1, which was the nation's national station, and it was under certain rules. But John Peel and John Walters, his producer, were allowed to do what they like. I don't know how they did it. And what they liked to do was play a lot of punk music. They played a lot of pub rock music to begin with, and then they moved into playing punk. Now suddenly you've got national radio playing it. Seymour Stein is coming over and signing punk band. You know, it snowballed. And like all musical movements, it's because of the circumstance. The band seemed to arrive and fill the hole.
Yeah. I get the feeling that the press was very much on your side at Stiff, that was sort of a part of the success. Is that right?
Well, there was five weekly newspapers, music newspapers, and they had to have a lot, you know, they had to have a lot of, there's journalists wandering around looking for stories for these five newspapers. And we were perfect. We were very aware of them, and we invented a lot of the stuff they wrote about. But also, we had the bands that were a bit interesting. They're a bit cutting edge. They're a bit, you know, they looked and felt a bit different. So, you know, there was a bit of rock and roll mayhem. There was all the things going on. And you had a lot of journalists at that time who wrote in depth about a trip or a gig or whatever else. I mean, England had a great thing, which is very handy for a manager. It's called Caught in the Act. So your band could be in two of those papers and somebody writing about two different venues that week and two different shows. So press coverage had a very big part to play, yes.
Yeah. So you started Stiff with Jake Riviera, another sort of legendary character. How much money did it take to start the label? Where did the money come from? And tell me about Jake Riviera and how you got along.
Well, the money from the point of view of Stiff was income, my income from managing Graham Parker and various other music at that time. And so my percentage from that was really what launched the label. There's a story that Dr. Feelgood, Lee Brillo, who I booked quite a bit, I also ran the Hope and Anchor pub as well at the time. So one of the pubs was the Hope and Anchor pub. And I had a studio. I built a studio in the pub, and I was recording quite a lot of people live And so he gave us £400, but that was it was never used. I think we had to check on the wall in a glass case, you know, for ages before. So it's a good rumor. Jake kind of copied me to a degree. I'm a little older than Jake, and I'd kind of been pushing more of the pub rock thing. And he had a band that was in the pub rock thing, Chilly Willy and the Red Hot Peppers. And so I did package shows, and then he did package shows. So we were kind of aware of each other. We were both kind of quite competitive people. Jake was a very talented ad man. He was very good with a good quote. Very Lennon and McCartney, I used to think. We were the poor man's Lennon and McCartney of management. So between us, we came up with some quite good stuff, and we both hated the majors. So that five weekly newspapers, for example, we manipulated more. The journalists liked us. We were snappier. We were younger. We were snappier. Our bands were a bit more noisier. And so, yes, we did get a lot of the press on our side. John Peel played the stuff from the beginning. He played So It Goes by Nick Lowe. And so Jake and I got on very well, and we had very good, you know, I had an office, I had telephones, I had a management, I had some income from managing people. So Jake joined in on that. He then had the income and, you know, the office and whatever. So we became a good partnership. Jake, I did describe Jake as a person who would burn the bridge while you were standing on it. And that was pretty much his persona. He was out there. He would take on anybody. Whereas some people would be cautious about a journalist or cautious about a situation, Jake would fly in the face. I would have to, from time to time, clean up behind him a little bit. I'm a little older and a little more diplomatic, shall we say.
Well, I'm sure that was helpful at sometimes, but also a liability at sometimes. Let me ask you this. If I were to ask, you know, Reckless Eric or Ian Dury, Elvis Costello, you know, Dave Edmonds, whoever those people, what you were like back then, what would they tell me off the record?
They would say, They all attribute sometimes far too much cleverness in me that I didn't have. You know what I mean? I think that's generally, but they know that I knew the records, that I knew the people, that I'd been on the road, that I knew how the thing worked, how the machinery worked. I knew I could pick the singles, I could promote, I could help them to get on. And, you know, hopefully I would get something out of it. You know, obviously, but so that's really, I think my reputation is as a marketing man. I mean, my best job was Legend by Bob Marley, but that's, I'm into finding the key to promoting the career of what I hope are great musicians. I mean, I'm a bit deaf now. And I tell people, I am deaf from listening to great music.
So let me, I'm going to hold you to, give me 1 minute or 2 minutes, nothing longer, because so many characters walked through the stiff door. So tell me 1 minute about each of these folks. Tell me about Barney Bubbles.
Barney Bubbles was a genius. And he studied art like we study groups or music or whatever we're interested in. He studied art for those things, and he went back several centuries to look at stuff. He was a bit of an acid casualty because he had taken quite a lot of psychedelics, but a lovely guy, and he wasn't into the money. He would forget to send invoices and things. He was always under some financial pressure because he hadn't been paid, but he hadn't asked people to pay him. He was into the art completely, and he was a huge asset to Stiff Records. We would not be the label that we turned out to be without Barney.
Yeah. Tell me about Rachel Sweet.
Rachel was an interesting thing. Well, they all have their merit. I heard Devo's Satisfaction. Somebody played me this record, and I thought, what the hell is that? That is extraordinary. Of all the kind of covers of Satisfaction I could think of, that was the least likely. And I meet with the Devo people. And I think Jerry Cassell is his name, the bass player. I think anyway, he's a real breadhead. He was talking to me about, I listened to a few of their material. They had four came around to this motel I'm in, and it's a blizzard outside. So he's telling me that Virgin and Warner's, you know, he's trying to get them to auction, to get the price up, etc. So there's no way he's going to sign to Stiff, because I'm trying to sell Stiff to him, that we would be the right label for him. So we did a deal for money for the three singles. So we had six tracks, and we would get the rights to put them out until such time as he got a big record deal. So while I'm there, a few people have heard, for some reason, I don't know what my reputation was, but a few people are phoning, and a gentleman called Liam Sternberg, who went on to write Walk Like an Egyptian. So you can see that boy had talent. He gets in touch and said, look, I know all the acts in Akron. If you're interested, you know, I could show you how it all works. And one of them was Rachel Sweet. And she had two tracks of Liam Sternberg that he had written, and she was singing. I thought, you know, she's 15. She had this really fresh, young girl voice of Patsy Cline, or, you know, you can think of several kind of very early, very young teenage voices. So I wrote her, put her down, and then Jane Eyre and various other bands. So I got the idea of doing an album of Akron unknowns, because to me, the tire capital of the world, I found very fascinating. There was a smell of burnt rubber in the air. Even with the snow, was kind of dark. So I was a bit, having got the Devo deal sorted, I was looking at what. So from that, it turned out that Rachel's mum, unfortunately, had died, had passed at that point. And her father, who was a bathroom salesman, was now acting as her manager, because the family were trying to hang together. So I kind of got Rachel and her dad as a package. So we brought her over and put her on a package tour in England, and she was great. She was very, very straight girl, very, very she knew what she wanted. She knew how to do it. 15, very, very young girl voice. And we had great success with her. And it was a lot of fun. Liam also came to work for Stiff eventually. Mm. And the Devo tracks, of course, were very successful. And people found them, you know, they were very interesting. I mean, to give them the due, they were really off the wall. They were, yeah.
Yeah. So were there surprises in the Stiff days of tracks you thought would be huge hits but didn't sell, and tracks the other way that you just didn't have an expectation for but turned out to sell huge quantities?
Well, I thought a record company made hits. I thought the job of the record company, it wasn't just to put out spaghetti on the wall and hope some of it clung. Mm. You know, my idea was, pick a song by an artist who's signed to you. Pick the right song. Think about how it would work. You know, have a kind of instinct for it. And then, you know, it's like a great story of Herb Alpert at A&M. He was the A of A&M, obviously. And he was in the office. He had nothing to do, because normally he was out on the road earning income that they were investing. So the marketing guy was in there, and Herb wanted to find out how it all worked, because it was going quite well. And he said, so how do you do it? How do you work it out? And the guy said, well, what we do is we look at the cost of an album, and then we think how many we're going to sell, right? And then we take 7% of that money and we use it in marketing. And Herb said, God, that's really interesting. Oh, it's a real science. It's really fantastic. He said, but what happens when it doesn't work? And the guy said, we spend what it takes. And that's how Stiff ran. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. I would pick the record and then I would make it happen. You know, I gave my record company away to madness, because there was a song called It Must Be Love that they did. That's a good story. They played it at a rehearsal that I was at of theirs. So they played this track, a little bit of this track. the keyboard player was always playing the piano, Mike Barson. And they played this track. And I said, what track is that? And he said, oh, it's a cover. We're not doing it, because Madness didn't do covers at that point. We're not doing it. I said, no. I said, you're not understanding. That's a really big hit. That's a seriously big international hit there. And he said, yeah, well, you know, we're not doing covers. You know? So I said, I really want to release that, Mike. And he said, out of just frivolity, the kind of person he is, he said, well, what do you give me to release it? I don't want to release it. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you my record company. I'll give you a letter, and you can have my entire record company, and I will work for 3 years for you at my current salary if that record is not a big hit. And he said, okay, what's a big hit? And I said, top five. And the record went to four.
I've never heard. That's a true story?
Absolutely true, yeah.
I've never heard that one. Let's just backtrack for 1 second. At some point during the Stiff years, you get approached by Island Records to run that label. Now, you've just talked about how you just hate, it seems like, the culture of major labels. This from day one, were you able to bring that that aesthetic to running Island? And I know that Island has a lot of ups and downs. Did you ride it up or ride it down?
Well, here's the situation, Michael. Chris Blackwell, in the very early days of Stiff, had distributed the label. I learned about labels I learned about pressing plastic. I learned about printing record sleeves. All those things were learned through my experience on whatever I was doing. Chris Blackwell, I approached somebody else in the label, and Chris Blackwell, who I knew vaguely, said, yeah, I think it's a good idea, your label, Dave. We'll distribute it, and we'll give you a good deal. And he did. So for a year, we were distributed by Island in the very, very beginning. So It Goes, the first 15 singles. And so I got very chummy with Chris Blackwell. But when I say chummy, I'm talking about we would have dinner three times a year, and I would tell him about what was happening in the British market, because he floated around a great deal, America, Jamaica, you know, he was Bermuda, he was always somewhere else. So he hassled me to run his label. It wasn't going very well at TV, and I didn't want to do it. Stiff was doing very well. I had a couple of new bands that I was really interested in, and I said, no, it's kind of you, Chris. You're very flattering, but no, I don't want to do it. And so he went on and on. About three times he came back to me, and eventually he came back and said, look, I'll buy half the company. You can decide how much it's worth. I'll buy half the shares in the company, and you come and run Island and Stiff together. So that was the point that, you know, I chatted over with my wife, and I thought, yeah. How long is the record label going to last? I like Island, and I didn't know any of the, Robert Palmer was a friend of mine. So I said, okay, fine. You buy half of Stiff, and I'll run the two together. I'll bring in some staff and stuff to cover whatever. So the very first board meeting, The head guy of Island England, the financial guy, says, okay, we've run out of money. Has anyone got any ideas? And I was outraged. I could not believe that I hadn't quite sold my office, whatever. But Stiff had some money. We would work very hard, and we had got somewhere. So I talked to Chris. I said, Chris, what is this? You know, is this a joke? He said, no, we're a bit short. I said, well, how come you didn't kind of bring this up when you were pitching to me as to whatever? How can I run a company where you've got no money, essentially? You know, and in fact, I've now looked at the accounts, and you're practically you're insolvent, which you're not allowed to run a company in the UK if you're insolvent. And he said, well, we've got some material coming up, you know, that's quite good. So I listened to all the material, and there wasn't a hit among it. There wasn't one hit. I found one track that I thought would go on the British chart. It was a novelty song, Hello, John, Got a New Motor. That was the name of the song, Hello, John, Got a New Motor. And that was it. But I don't know. I'm an idiot from time to time, and I like a challenge, you know. And so I took it on. It turned out that he didn't even have the money to buy my shares. Uh-huh. I had to lend him the money so he could buy my shares at the price that we decided on. So it was foolishness. I mean, you know, in hindsight, but we're all good at the hindsight. He had a track, though. You see, I always go for the music. I've always signed people because they're songwriters. I always think the songwriting is where it's at. And I always follow the music trail. And he had a track that Trevor Horn has produced by Frankie Goes to Hollywood that was bumbling around in the chart and not going anywhere. It's at 65. In the British chart, if you stay at 65 for 2 or 3 weeks, you're done for. So I thought this track could be different. Could we, you know? So I brought the stiff people and the stiff attitude to it. And we really worked very hard and we got very lucky. The BBC then banned it very publicly. And I kind of tricked the head of the BBC into taking part in a press conference and mentioning that he thought the song was being banned because it was all about ejaculation. And when he told me that, I said, you're out of your mind. This is the head of the BBC. I said, most of the chart songs are about ejaculation, Ted. Don't worry about it. So he stood up in front of a press conference, which I put together. I had 170 people listening to the BBC head saying this. Right? I couldn't press enough records. People were falling over themselves. I was pressing in Afghanistan. Do you know what I mean? It was ridiculous, the demand. And then I realized that you could put out 3 different mixes with the same number. So I could withdraw one lot, the same number, put another lot. I'm a marketing man at the end of the day, Michael. You know, I love the music and I love it, but also I'm interested in marketing. That's the job of the record company. I don't like the majors because they wait and see if the group can get off by themselves. They don't market them. And right now they sign people that have numbers on Spotify. I mean, what kind of business is that? How many fish in the sea? I'm interested in finding the band that's really good and have no chance. That's my kind of group. Anyway, Ireland were like that when I got through the financial figures. And Bob Marley had unfortunately passed away. And I'm a Bob Marley fan. I love his music. And I spent a month in the south of France at a house that Chris Wright owned. Chris Wright is Chrysalis, right? So I'm at his house for a month in the south of France. And after a week, I'm really bored. I mean, the family are there and they're jumping in the swimming pool. It's all really good, but I'm bored at that point. And I went through he had his entire catalogue in this room, vinyl. So I spent the next 3 days going through the entire Chrysalis catalogue. And there was very little I thought were any good at all. Quite honestly, I thought it was all rubbish. But his wife is a huge Bob Marley fan, and she had the whole Bob Marley catalogue there. And from that, I kind of made a cassette for myself for the car. When I came back to England, I thought, I'll have a great Bob Marley cassette in the car. So I pretty much made legends at that point due to boredom. And so Frankie Goes to Hollywood, I mean, selling like hotcakes. I think eventually that single did, you know, 3 or 4 million in the UK and Europe. Then Legend becomes the labor of love, and I look for the artwork. I thought Ireland always pushed Bob Marley too militant. I thought the public thought he was kind of, he didn't like white people or something, you know? And I thought that was incredibly bad, because what a songwriter he was, and what a visionary songwriter. So we did that, and we sold zillions of that. I mean, it's something like 38 million now at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, and that, I would say, of all the reggae or all Jamaican music played today, like 60% of it is that one album. It's kind of, you've ruined it in some ways, you know?
Yes, I think that's right. That's right.
Just to backtrack a second, so eventually Jake left Stiff with, I think, Nick and Elvis, and they had their thing, and you had your thing, including really that what we talked about before, the huge success of Madness. And I think they were really much bigger in the UK than they were in the US. They were really...
Yes, they didn't like to tour. Mm. And Sire Records had them in the States. Seymour had spotted them around the same time as me. I auditioned them at my wedding. So my wife doesn't entirely love them.
What was the end of Stiff Records? What was the actual end for you?
The end was that Ireland didn't pay the bills. In order to amalgamate the two Chris Blackwell sold me a bill of goods about he wanted to sell the record companies to a bigger company. And I would work for 3 years on the road. I would have a very big slice of the overall profit of the sale. I'd have half of Stiff, which would be very good. And I'd already had a little money out of it, so it was good. And he essentially double-crossed me, where that was it. They didn't pay the accounts department were melted together, merged, and they weren't paying Stiff's bills. They were paying Ireland's bills. Ireland was making a lot of money. Ireland had the biggest year of its entire career in 1984. It was the first year I took it over and I worked it. And it didn't have anything, though. It didn't have any upcoming artists. I wanted to get upcoming artists, because if we're going to sell it a couple of years down the road, you need to have upcoming business and upcoming artists. But Blackwell wanted to pick the artists, and he had lost his touch quite a bit. Anyway, I don't want to slag Chris Blackwell off too much. He wrote a book, and he gave me a very nice chapter in it, which is good. But the bottom line is that he owes me about 12 million quid, and I'm very unlikely to see that in the future.
Wow.
But he was a genius. He's also known as the Babyface Killer. Did you know that?
I did not know that, no.
Yeah. Well, he is. He's a very charming, very handsome man in his prime, very good talker, very charming. He talked whatever, and I went along with him for longer than I should. But that's the way. I never proposed that I was a big businessman. It's not something I thought. Great music, a great record company, there's income in it, and you'll get some of it. I was never looking at the bottom line and querying it at any time. Not that I'm precious or a saint or anything. I wouldn't know what was happening in my department, the same way Blackwell knew what he was selling me at the time. Hmm. So I had to make it work, and I made it work. And then his people, that was it. It's the Babyface Killer. So Stiff found it hard to go back on the street and survive because it had a lot of creditors at that point. I'd signed the Pogues, for example, Pogues at that time, and they became a very big band. I never entirely lost the knack of finding a marketing. But if you have a record company and you're the head of it, like Clive Davis, your records did very well because you got your staff and your income and you put it behind a certain record to make it work. You know, the Madness story is to show that how far you would go to try and make a record work that you believed in.
So do you still benefit from the assets of Stiff Records?
No, I don't. No. It's owned by Trevor Horn's wife, Jill Sinclair, ended up buying it for not a huge sum of money. And I worked for a year and a half for her running the label. And at the very end of it, I gave away to, you know, Madness got their catalogue back, Elvis Costello got his record back, The Damned got their stuff back, Ian Dury got their stuff back. So everybody who was big on the label ended up owning what it is that the label had had. So what's left of the catalogue, Trevor Horn, the producer, he sold it along with everything that he owned, perfect songs and very, to Universal for a huge sum of money, which I didn't get, and I don't share it.
Interesting. So since those days, you've done a million things. You've represented labels out there. You've helped move acid jazz and drum and bass get started in the UK. You've done a lot of consulting, and I also read that you did a lot of horse breeding. And when I read you did a lot of horse breeding, I think, well, that's not something poor people do. So without getting too personal, I, you know, through all the ups and downs, I guess you've done very well. Is that fair?
Well, I've done okay, Michael. I'm not complaining about it. You've done okay. I still do stuff. I go out on the road occasionally and do one-man show, which is, you know, there's a few people talking about making that a bigger thing. There's a bit of interest. So okay is the answer, really. I mean, I'm a certain age now, and I'm still going, and I'm still keen, and I'm still wanting to do stuff. And I still know what a hit record is, and I do lots and lots of bits of projects and stuff. I've done a lot of greatest hits for other record labels. I've got some royalties from those.
I see now you're involved with this brand new band called Hardwick Circus, who's about to release their second album. And I assume that the reason you are involved in this band is because you are feeling magic from them. I assume it's not a financial. I assume that's very low on your considerations of why you are working with this band. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm trying to help the band to realize its potential. You know, at the very end of any of those things, there is some income for me. You know, if they realize their potential, there is a contract, and I will get paid. Nothing excessive, but again, that's what it's about. I'm very interested in music. I'm very interested still in the chemistry of music. I still dislike the major record companies that I've disliked all my life. They're a great motivation. They motivate me every day. And it's exciting business. And you have to keep going at the end of the day to for yourself. I mean, what I have friends who've retired and passed away almost, you know, immediately. It's, you know, you hope to go out with a bang, if you're going to go, which you are. And so this is a very good band, and I've led them along the road to how to do it, how to write it, how to be it. And I think everyone who's seen them, I mean, last night, remarkably, everyone who's seen them goes, how did that happen? And I'm thinking, that's how Stiff happened. That's how everything that's good happens, is that you get behind it. You put your shoulders to the wheel and you get behind it. But you can only do that if they want you to. That's the thing. It's only when people want to get there and are prepared to move, to do it, and to struggle and strive and work, that it can happen. So I only take on people who are driven like me a bit, you know.
Gotcha. So at the end of the day, what is your biggest gift?
My mouth. I don't take no for an answer. I'm very persevering. I don't give up anything. If there's a I try and find stuff that's timeless. I think a lot of Stiff material, I believe, but that could be just me. A lot of it sounds really good. It was made on a tiny budget, but the songs were good, and we tried to make, you know, the old killer, no filler attitude. That's me. I think all albums should be a greatest hit, all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea that you've got a one track and then it's cobbled together to make a release or whatever. I deplore that kind of attitude. It's what else have you got? You've got three great songs here. Can you write more? Is this a fluke? Is this something that just happened to you? Or can you steady up now and write and get down and find some really interesting things that appeal to you and write about them? You know, I think all music is kind of folk music. It's all about the locale. The Beatles were folk music from Liverpool, and they incorporated the world to a degree. I like people writing. Madness write about Camden Town, as you say. They didn't do anything in America, although they had one hit. I think it was Our House. Yeah. But because Seymour... He's great. Seymour passed on very, very recently. I loved him. He was great fun. But he was an American record executive, and that was his kind of interest. But he liked music, and he liked finding new acts and things. It's a great business. I mean, this is a business. We're talking about it now, and how amazing is that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's an amazing story, and just great stories. So thanks for visiting with us. Just so much fun this morning.
Great, Michael. Thank you very much. Cheers, Michael. All the best.
Sex and drugs and rock and roll is all my brain and body need. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. It's very good indeed. Keep your silly ways or throw them out the window. The wisdom of your ways, I've been there and I know lots of other ways. What a jolly bad show. If all you ever do is business you don't like. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Sex and drugs and rock and roll is very good indeed. Every bit of clothing ought to make you pretty. You can cut the clothing. Grey is such a pity. I should wear the clothing of Mr. Walter Mitty. See my tailor, he's called Simon. I know you're quite welcome, it is free. Don't do nothing that is cut price. You know what they'll make you be. They will try their tricky device, trap you with the ordinary. Get your teeth into a small slice, the cake of liberty. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Sex and drugs and rock and roll. Sex and drugs and rock and roll.